Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Retired Marine Corps General James Mattis was President Donald Trump's first Secretary of Defense, and the appointment was highly praised at the time. Secretary Mattis believed in keeping the United States military apolitical. He believed in restoring the military's budget for force readiness, and he believed America is stronger because of her allies. Not all of his beliefs, however, completely meshed with the new commander-in-chief. Guy Snodgrass served as Director of Communications and Chief Speechwriter to Secretary Mattis. He had an up-close and personal look at the workings of Washington during a tumultuous time in American history. His new book is called Holding the Line, Inside Trump's Pentagon with Secretary Mattis. Snodgrass is a former naval officer and combat pilot. Today, he's founder and CEO of Defense Analytics. That's a strategic consulting and advisory firm. And he joins us on the phone now from Burke, Virginia. Guy Snodgrass, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
You know, you have an interesting life as a combat pilot, as a Navy man, without ever accepting this appointment to work with Secretary Mattis. And then it gets just a little more interesting, in fact, even historic. Tell us a little bit about why you wanted to work with the former general in this role.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As someone who was actively serving as a member of America's military at the time, certainly I knew of General Mattis's reputation. He has a longstanding reputation, not only as a very good warrior from the Marine Corps, but also as a scholar and someone who just has a real depth and knowledge of history. And that's something that had always appealed to me throughout my time in uniform. So, let's be honest, when someone like Secretary Mattis reaches out and says, I need you to come work for me, typically the right answer and the only answer is happy to serve and to go work with him.
In that vein, tell me about his office closet when he sort of takes you into this space and show, and you get a look at his mind and what kind of note taker and scholar he really is. Tell us about that day and what you found.
Sure. This is one of the first personal interactions I had with Secretary Mattis. And like you said, I'd been a speechwriter before, and that was a difficult job because that boss didn't have as much public speaking experience. And that just meant that there wasn't like this wealth of knowledge you could tap into to learn their voice. Well, with Secretary Mattis, it was the opposite, and it was fantastic. So as you mentioned, we have an entire hour with the secretary in his personal office. We're listening to him tell us what he finds to be the most important, what he wants to accomplish as Secretary of Defense, and the way in which we should do that, which resounding theme is that we want to be apolitical all the way through, whether you're on the right side of the aisle, the left side of the aisle, doesn't matter. All sides are welcome when it comes to America's defense. And he wanted to make sure we always emphasize that. And as part of the resources he made available, he referred us back to his closet. And so as his director of communications over a year and a half, I could access all the speeches he'd ever given, a lot of the personal notes he had taken. And he had an entire row of Moleskine notebooks where he had kept just decades of his kind of daily thoughts. So it was just a treasure trove to be able to learn your boss's voice, to be able to understand his worldview, and then, of course, do the best job you could in making him sound like his best self.
Yeah. I would never have left that room. It's going to be like so. I mean, you must like open a notebook and say like, "I'll be here for a while." But let's talk a little about his voice, because in the you mentioned his reputation, and does he have an awareness, you know, in the Marines that sort of, the reverence, the legacy, you know, the Chesty Puller, the Al Gray, the sort of, legendary status that some of these Marine generals have, because some of the things he says, and you talk about some of his famous quotations early on in the book, including always carry a knife with you just in case there's cheesecake or you need to stab someone in the throat. That's straight up Marine Corps history right there. Like, they're going to put that in the book that you get at boot camp. Does he have an awareness of sort of his place in Marine Corps history?
He does. I would say the honest answer, yes, absolutely he does. One of the most important things to him is his legacy. I think that's why when I shared with him that I wanted to pursue this project, he was a little concerned. Because, you know, as a senior leader, whether in the Marine Corps or anywhere else in the U.S. military, there's just this expectation you'd like to be able to set your own narrative. And I'll never forget a great quote I've loved for years that came from Winston Churchill, of course, former Prime Minister of Britain during World War II. And he said that he intended for history to be kind to him because he was going to write most of it. And I think that that's a great perspective into the way, you know, someone like Secretary Mattis sees the world and others. So he was acutely aware of that he represented the Marine Corps, that he represented America's military on the world stage. And he wanted to live up not only just for his own reputation, but he wanted to live up to those best ideals of what those coming behind him should also live up to.
And he wants to get his goals accomplished, which is not always an easy thing to do in Washington. But before we talk about that, tell me, as you worked on the project, where did you sort of, you also have sort of the mantle of history over you as you write this book, because as an inside observer and participant in this time in history, where do you see this book kind of fitting into that historical narrative in the future? Because there's a lot of change happening at this time. We get to see a lot of things happening in the administration, private conversations, private frustrations. How did you approach that as an author?
So I was acutely aware that since there was this kind of cone of silence that existed over the Pentagon during Mattis's tenure, there just wasn't a lot of information available, publicly available, and especially from a firsthand source who had actually had the opportunity to help craft a lot of our national level strategies, our policies, our relationships with world leaders, and of course, working alongside someone like Secretary Mattis. So I felt like it was a terrific opportunity to help further openness and transparency. It's a bedrock principle that Americans have expected from their government for many, many, you know, decades. And it's one of those things that I wanted this book to stand the test of time. I wanted to take an apolitical approach so that you couldn't say it was politically motivated either from the left or from the right. It was just, here's someone who has a firsthand account, who is willing to speak truth to power, to share that with the American public, but then also isn't afraid to highlight areas where I think we could be doing better. But all along that journey, I did a lot of research. I wanted to make sure that it was a memoir underpinned by facts and by factual accounts that your listeners could seek for themselves. I mean, I didn't want this to be simply what I'd read so many times throughout my life, which is a memoir, which is just through one point of view. They're trying to compel you to believe what they believe. I wanted to provide something that could basically serve as a very concise one-stop shop for a two-year look at the relationship between Mattis and Trump, and then also the relationship between America's military and other allies and nations around the world.
And in doing so, you have to be unflinching about when Mattis makes a misstep. So for an example, tell us a little bit about one of the first meetings with Senator John McCain and how Mattis's maybe was not paying as close attention to one of his constitutional duties.
Well, you're right. And that's something that, unfortunately, we had been warned about, and Secretary Mattis had been warned about, was that he was not spending enough time with the elected leaders of our nation, both on the Democratic and on the Republican side of the aisle. And, you know, that is, as a four-star general, you can get away with that. As Secretary of Defense, by definition, you have a political job. You are a cabinet secretary serving the President of the United States, and you have a significant obligation to communicate routinely with members of Congress because they have that oversight role of the legislative branch. So we had let that relationship atrophy, and man, as you alluded to have been Mattis's plus one. He brought me into the meeting with him to have seen just how irate and how frustrated the late Senator John McCain was that he was not hearing from Secretary Mattis these issues of national and international significance. In this case, what the readers will find in one of the chapters of the book is how this meeting is about the disposition of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, and just how furious McCain was that Mattis had kept him in the dark, and it prevents Congress from doing and from conducting its oversight role. And but it was also interesting to see that at the end of that conversation, when Mattis, the light bulb goes on, it takes a little while. We were all tired. We just returned from a trip, if memory serves, to Jordan. And when the light bulb goes on, he just says, "Senator, we're going to do that for you." Suddenly the tone shifts. McCain was happy. and now we're moving on. So it was just, you know, again, a front row seat to see what it's like to make these major decisions on the national stage.
After like 32 hours of no sleep, by the way, on that trip, you're working,
right.
You're working the whole entire time on the plane, and you come in on very little sleep, and so does Secretary Mattis. Talk a little bit about his, you know, the disconnect that a lot of us saw happening about what General Mattis would say to sort of reassure allies, and then what the president would say that would sometimes shock General Mattis. And tell us a little bit about the importance of allies as a Secretary of Defense saw it, and how America does not stand alone, and a president who really came in with an American first, campaign model.
Well, the reminder here is that when you say something like America first, it doesn't mean and doesn't have to mean America alone. So, yes, we need to work to get our fiscal house in order. We need to work to strengthen our own military. But it doesn't mean that you necessarily stand back and walk back from these multinational alliances that exist around the world. Of course, you mentioned NATO. Of course, we have longstanding alliances with many nations in the Indo-Pacific, like Japan and South Korea, Philippines, Thailand, Australia. And then, of course, into the Middle East, where we have active ongoing military operations. And the danger is that when you make an ad hoc decision, when the president fires off a wayward tweet that has the appearance of changing America's longstanding policy, like that we're retrenching and we're stepping away from our allies, like we saw recently with Syria, those nations will actively question America's resolve, not only in the moment, but ask themselves and ask the other partners in the region, well, does this signify that America is stepping away from the world stage? Are we abrogating our leadership role and our responsibility? And if so, should they start to partner with other nations like Russia or China or Iran in the Middle East? And that's the real danger, is that sometimes if you haven't fully thought through a decision like that, when you send out a tweet, it feels very satisfying. You've kind of shocked everybody. You've maybe drawn their attention to the latest piece of shiny foil. But what you've really done is you've called into question these longstanding alliances. And those took decades to build. And of course, they'll take years to continue to strengthen if we're not mindful of that fact in the current day.
There are inside conversations and moments that are both touching and funny, but this is not a salacious kind of tell-all book. It's a really important policy look as well. And I'm wondering, now that you've moved on to a different role and you look back, what did you learn that you think America really needs to be keyed into about the role of the U.S. military and America's relationship with it?
One is, I think, the danger of placing America's military on a pedestal. I've known for years. I mean, I've always appreciated that Americans do not hesitate to, especially when I was in uniform, pull you aside and say, thank you for your service and thanks for serving. And, you know, my response is always, well, it's easy because you're worth it. I mean, we obviously feel genuinely a large sense of pride in having the opportunity to serve in uniform and to have that kind of role in protecting America and defending our interests abroad. The number one thing that my experience really led me to believe is, one, just the important role that America plays on the world stage. I lived abroad in Japan for 6 years as a member of the military. I visited dozens of foreign countries, and they have a very widespread, universal respect for America, sometimes approaching near reverence. And again, that's something that serves not only those nations' security needs, but it also serves our own security needs as well. As we think about the global war on terror, and the fact that America benefits greatly from an economic sense by maintaining those longstanding relationships. So there's a lot to like there. And that touches on, I guess, kind of the part B of the question, which is just the importance of having a strategy. You can accomplish so much if you foster transparency and alignment within an organization, if you make sure that everyone on your team is supported, that they are working and all rowing in the same direction. It's amazing what you can accomplish. And of course, I think we've seen in recent years where if you catch your team off guard, you can also make their life incredibly difficult, which ultimately undermines your own position.
The book is called Holding the Line Inside Trump's Pentagon with Secretary Mattis. The author is Guy Snodgrass, call sign Bus. Thanks so much for being here, sir. We appreciate your time.
You bet, Lori. Thank you.